Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to another episode of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Explainer podcast series. My name is William Held. I'm the Deputy Director of the Regulatory Transparency Project, and I am excited to be here today with Jeff Steyer, Senior Fellow at the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Will. It's great to be here.
And we are here to talk about the tension between regulation versus innovation. Obviously, this is something that is a core of RTP's mission to examine these types of issues. Obviously, this is always something that we deal with as a society, having to navigate. Tell us a little bit about this tension. What are sort of the balancing, what are the aspects of it that society's trying to balance and regulators are trying to balance?
Exactly. Well, very often we look, when we regulate new products, we ask the obvious and appropriate question, what are the risks? What are the dangers of having this new product? And very often we tend to fall into the trap of following what they call the precautionary principle. You've heard of that. It's, well, unless we could prove something is absolutely safe, we shouldn't use it. Why should we take on the new risk? That's something that is in place definitely in Europe, but has been more and more in place in the United States. But you can't always prove beyond a reasonable doubt that something is always absolutely safe. And I would posit that that's the wrong question to be asking, because is it safe according compared to what? Compared to what alternative? Is it safe compared to the status quo? What are the benefits of having these new products? What are the harms we're trying to eliminate? And very often we just say, well, it's got to be absolutely safe. We can't afford any new risk, right? Our grandmother always said, it better safe than sorry. And that sounds sensible. But I would suggest we need to look at each issue in terms of, what if we have this precautionary principle in place? What are the potential downsides? What are the unintended consequences? And what we've seen over the past few years more and more is that we take this precautionary principle approach, and we wind up potentially losing a lot of benefits that would have improved society, that would make us all better off. And as we'll get to later in the discussion, I really believe that if we have a more balanced approach, recognizing the benefits of new innovative products, that we could have even have a more civil political dialogue, and we'll get into that.
Great. Well, look forward to the intersection of those two issues. Give us some examples of where you might see this tension, new products that are coming out, that where people have had to balance these issues.
Yeah. Well, one of the most controversial issues today, and it's probably not even okay to say it's controversial, is climate change. Right. One of the allegations is that eating red meat. Is one of the biggest contributors to climate change. And we could argue about the degree of climate change, whether it's man-made, whether it's cow-made, right? That's one of the big allegations. In fact, one part of the Green New Deal would get rid of eating meat. In Europe, people have talked consistently about having a meat tax, right? A sin tax on eating meat because of its effect on climate change. Now, put aside for a moment your view on climate change or how big of a factor eating meat is. There was one person, Patrick Brown, a biochemist at Stanford University, who thought, and this is a serious scientist, thought that eating meat was the biggest impact on climate change, and it was a threat to the entire Earth. And he spent years trying to come up with approaches. He would have these conferences, usually government-funded type conferences, about sustainable agriculture in the 21st century and all of these conversations and bringing in academics. And what he found was he wasn't moving the needle. People still ate meat. Look, vegetarians were eating veggie burgers, but meat eaters like me, recognizing that maybe there's an impact from it, would still eat meat. And something happened, something clicked. And all of a sudden, instead of thinking like a big government academic regulator, something changed. And Pat Brown recognized, you know what? Why can't we think like innovators? What is it about meat, from his mindset, that people know how harmful it is? We've been talking about how the world can't sustain all of this meat. And they keep eating it. What are we doing wrong? And instead of thinking about climate change tax on meat and banning meats and warnings, he said, what is it about meat that people love? And it turns out, after his company, Impossible Foods, got funding from Google and Bill Gates and other innovation-oriented folks, they hired scientists, real scientists, food scientists, agricultural scientists, and asked these questions, what is it about meat? And a big part of it was the heme, like hemoglobin, something in the blood that gives meat that bloody good flavor and texture and mouthfeel, which you don't really have in veggie burgers of yesteryear. And they said, oh, what if we put some hemoglobin into this plant-based veggie burger we're gonna build, we're gonna recreate, we're gonna destruct meat from a cow and chemically put it back together from plant-based items. The problem was heme doesn't exist in nature widely outside of blood. But they found some leg hemoglobin from legumes in the root of a soy plant. They found some. And they said, you know, we can make heme-based plant burgers using this leg hemoglobin. The problem was there wasn't enough of it to mass produce it to make a dent in the problem. So again, went back to science. And they were able to genetically modify yeast to act as a petri dish to grow more leg hemoglobin that originated in the root of a soy plant that they couldn't mass produce. And now they were able to develop this Impossible Burger that really does have, to some degree, a much closer taste and mouthfeel and flavor of meat. And in fact, meat eaters like me now enjoy, occasionally, the Impossible Burger. And there are other competitors. There's Beyond Burger. It's not about the Impossible Burger, but it's the story of the Impossible Burger. And they, of course, had to overcome a number of hurdles. And that's where we get into the regulatory and interesting story. Well, I mentioned that Pat Brown, an environmentalist who thought climate change was a big issue. I mentioned he used genetically modified yeast in order to accomplish his goal of having us eat fewer hamburgers. Well, that didn't sit too well, as you could imagine, with some of the environmentalists. In fact, for a lot of environmental groups, their opposition to biotechnology or genetically modified foods is a sacred cow, if you will. And so he was up against ideological opposition from, in a way, his own camp. And that created a challenge. In addition to the challenge of bringing this product to market that tasted like cow meat. But he faced other challenges. In order to get regulatory approval, he had to show, Impossible Foods had to show, so they were getting into restaurants before any regulatory approval. Leg hemoglobin is much like everything else in hamburgers, and they were selling in smaller restaurants. But they wanted to market it as an alternative to cow meat, and they, in fact, called it plant-based meat. Well, you could imagine that didn't sit too well with the farmers who saw a competitor in this plant-based meat. They said, we have meat from cows. You can't call it meat. You may recall just a couple of years ago, the former FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, talked about almond milk and whether the dairy farmers were right. You can't call almond milk, according to the federal definition, the FDA definition of milk. Milk has to come from a lactating animal. And as Dr. Gottlieb, when he was at FDA, infamously said, almonds don't lactate. So you can't call it milk. So now you go into a store and you see almond beverage, you know, like were we really getting fooled? But now on the Impossible Burger issue, the plant-based meat issue, Pat Brown wanted to call it plant-based meat for a reason, for a real marketing reason, I assume, just like the almond milk folks did. And now there's another battle coming up. Can you call it plant-based meat? And then finally, in order to get that regulatory approval necessary to get it into places like White Castle, Impossible Burger was selling as they were scaling up in smaller restaurants. Interestingly, they were not targeting green, crunchy restaurants. They were targeting places like White Castle. But when you get to those bigger chain restaurants, they want to have some assurance that the regulators approve of this. So they were looking for something called generally recognized as safe status, GRAS. So this product needed to be GRAS in order to get into, to make companies like White Castle comfortable selling this on a mass level, as opposed to, you know, in some diner somewhere where no health issues were reported. So what do you do when you're a company and you need to get approval from an agency? You hire consultants. So they went to the consultants and said, how do we get GRAS? We know it's safe, but how do we get this recognized as safe? And they said, well, you need to run a series of laboratory tests and give high doses of this new product, the leg hemoglobin that you grew through genetic modification of yeast. You need to force feed a lot of it to some lab animals. And I believe approximately 83 or so rodents were slaughtered in this study that got them the grass, that got it into White Castle. Now I think they're in Burger King and elsewhere. But the rats were killed. And that did not sit well with PETA, the extreme animal rights group. And PETA went after Impossible Burgers for needlessly killing all the rats. They could have kept serving it without. You know, you could obviously say that maybe PETA should have been upset with the FDA for requiring these tests, but maybe that wouldn't have been as big of a news hook. So now go back to Impossible Burger. You're trying to save the world from what you think is a real problem, us eating too much meat. You recognize that you need to stop thinking like an academic or a regulator and start thinking like a profit-driven innovator. But in order to do that, you need to be able to appeal to people. Instead of saying it's genetically modified yeast leg hemoglobin, you say it's plant-based meat. Oh, I like meat. Maybe I'd like plant-based meat. But you run into opposition there from the regulators or from entrenched interests trying to use the regulators for their competitive interest, right? Instead of competing in the marketplace, my big criticism, while I love what Impossible Foods is doing, my criticism of Impossible Foods is they apparently don't have enough confidence in their product and they want to pass a meat tax, an animal meat tax, but still want to be called meat. So when you're in the position of an innovator, you've got to worry not only about the very difficult science of creating a disruptive, innovative product, but competing with all of the varied interests, whether it's the entrenched company that's selling the product you're trying to disrupt by calling it meat. And, you know, there are good arguments on both sides of that, but the idea that the cattle people weren't confident enough, they haven't innovated enough to be able to compete with this product, maybe this will spur some innovation for them to be greener, whatever it may be. You run into opposition from the environmental activists who don't want genetically modified foods, and you even run into opposition from PETA. But the FDA did the right thing. They did give them the GRAS status, and as we know, Impossible Burger has done really well. We're now on Impossible Burger 2.0. Beyond Meat is competing with them, and now everyone is coming out and trying to compete, and I think that's good for consumers. I think it's good for civil debate, civil society, because instead of you trying to control how I live because you think meat is killing the world, instead of taxing me and regulating me and warning label me to death, you give me more options. And that's the beauty of innovation driven by better science. And I think when we want to improve the world, the title of the piece that I wrote on this was A Recipe for a Better World, 9 parts innovation and 1 part regulation. Yes, we need some regulation, but we need to be focused on innovation.
So it sounds like the innovators at Impossible Burger ran into a combination of hurdles. There was the scientific hurdles that they had to deal with that, you know, those are sort of the rules of the universe that they're trying to figure out. Where do we find this chemical? Oh, we found it. Then how do we mass produce it? And we found this way of mass producing it. But then at each step, there was some sort of regulatory hurdle. And those kind of had different natures. And one is the precautionary principle that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. And that was the general sense that we need to make sure this is safe for human consumption. But there was also several times both there were other players in the market who were concerned that this would decrease their market share, and so they were trying to use regulation as somewhat of as a cudgel or as a way to keep Impossible Burger out of their market. And then thirdly, there were people who wanted to sort of do a similar thing. They wanted to use regulation while the FDA's concern was to make sure that Impossible Burger was safe by requiring lab testing. PETA had, shall we say, moral or moralistic concerns about how that was going to be done. And kind of confusingly, they went after the company rather than the FDA, because the company wasn't the one that came up with the test. It was the FDA that required it. So what I really love about this conversation, Jeff, and these issues is they're not just sort of the normal or the run-of-the-mill, hey, you know, we always want to be making government smaller. The sort of libertarian argument. There's a lot of different issues that we're balancing here. The concern of existing market players, the concern of safety, the concern of people who might have moral objections to what's going on. And we have to kind of decide as a society, collectively, how we're going to resolve those issues and hopefully do it in a way that we continue to have a significant amount of innovation. Because one thing I'm going to ask you to talk about is what do we lose out? Like, let's say, you know, obviously the case of Impossible Burger, you know, we would have lost a new form of food and potentially a way to reduce climate emissions or the harmful effects of farming have on our environment. But generally speaking, taking it at 30,000 foot level, what are the cost benefits we're trying to balance when we think about regulation versus innovation?
Well, while I'm skeptical about opposed to the precautionary principle, the reason I called my piece Nine Parts Innovation, One Part Regulation, why one part? Jeff, you're a libertarian. Well, I want regulation. I want us to have things that are safe, but I don't want regulation to stifle innovation, new life-saving products. And Will, I'm not just talking about pharmaceutical or medical devices. If you think climate change puts us all at risk because in large part because of eating animals, I want you to think like Patrick Brown. I want you to think, instead of regulating, warning, taxing, all of this stuff, try to create an environment that fosters innovation, that fosters investment in innovation. And when you have such an uphill battle to bring a new product to market, as Impossible Burger did, and as we'll get to in the next topic even more, uphill battles to bring new innovative, disruptive innovations to market, to what degree does that prevent investors in new innovative ideas for problems that we didn't even think science could solve? To what degree does that overhanging risk of regulation from all those different sources, whether it was competitors, whether it was environmentalists or ideologues or moralists, that potential regulatory cost that will come about with a new product, what problems might be solved that we're not even getting to because the dollars aren't flowing to the scientists, or the scientists aren't getting the funding because they're not going to be able to bring this new product to the market because we live in a world with lots of risk. I mean, glyphosate, the litigation around glyphosate, Roundup, the weed killer. In California, of course, they got this $2 billion jury verdict. Now, that product was approved by the USDA, said it was absolutely safe, the levels we're exposed to, it doesn't cause cancer. Every government regulatory agency in the world said it doesn't cause cancer at the levels that were exposed to Roundup, the weed killer, or glyphosate. But now the company, used to be Monsanto, now it's Bayer, is on the hook for these billion-dollar verdicts with more coming. Well, why would I want to invest in the next new, great new innovation that promotes agriculture at lower costs, by the way, with a much smaller global climate footprint, using new technology? Why would I invest in that? Because even if I go through the regulatory hurdles, I'm still going to get hit with lawsuits 20 years down the road. Why would I want to invest in that? And who would want to buy that from me? If we live in this innovation-averse environment from a regulatory and litigation perspective, and that's what worries me.
And it's not, you mentioned Roundup and Impossible Burger, but there are lots of examples of products that are in the process or have hit regulatory burdens. Give us you don't have to go into as much detail as you did on Parsable, but just give people some examples of sort of things that they might be find useful in their, you know, in their day-to-day lives that is had a battle or is having one right now.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as a public health advocate on the right, I look at private sector innovation to help make problems better, to help reduce problems, reduce harm. And what I do is I look for the low-hanging fruit. Where are the big problems? And where are free market conservatives not having a voice? Well, what's the big problem in public health, not just today, but for years? It's the fact that people smoke cigarettes. They are really harmful. Cigarettes kill. Well, wouldn't it be great if we had something that satisfied smokers with much, much less harm? It doesn't have to overcome the regulatory precautionary principle burden. The government never solved that problem, right? It taxed smokers. It regulated. It put warning labels on it, which wound up protecting industry from litigation. But it didn't really come up with a solution. But today, many smokers are quitting smoking using e-cigarettes. And everyone knows the story and the battle and the challenge with youth vaping, the alleged health risks. But if you zoom out and look at the big picture, this is a product that, according to Public Health England, is the government in England, is 95% less harmful than smoking. We'll concede that you shouldn't start using this product and kids shouldn't use it. But it is a free market, private sector driven innovation that could be a boon to public health. Yet if you look at the news coverage, at least in the United States, this is the biggest threat to public health, they say. Well, smoking is the biggest threat to public health, and e-cigarettes, products like Juul, or even newer innovations like heated tobacco products. And I salute the FDA for authorizing the marketing of a heated tobacco product called IQOS, which will be rolling out soon. These types of innovative products, while not entirely safe, have the potential to make us all better off. While you shouldn't initiate use of these products if you're a smoker, or if you're going to become a smoker and you fit that risk profile, you're for whatever reason, you're going to take on some risks, I would rather people get their nicotine from a much less harmful source than the most harmful source you could imagine, which is the combustible product. And the danger of smoking, as the FDA has repeatedly said, the danger of cigarettes is from the combustion, the products of combustion, not the nicotine. So now there are people innovating, coming up with lower risk nicotine products, and we need to have an infrastructure, a regulatory mindset that encourages this innovation. And it was not the government that came up and took the financial risk of a lower risk nicotine product. It was the private sector that's investing in it today. And they're coming up, they've addressed to a large degree the scientific difficulties of creating a lower risk product that delivers nicotine in a much less harmful way. But the government has gotten in the way. And it's not just the government that has gotten in the way. If you go back to the impossible food analogy where the cattlemen were against it and the environmental activists and the animal rights activists, who else sells nicotine? Big Pharma sells nicotine. Now, if nicotine were the answer, we wouldn't have a smoking problem anymore because the FDA has already approved the gum in the patch.
The gum in the patch.
Well, it's about the delivery system.
Right. Part of it is the habit.
Yes, the habit as well as how well it delivers nicotine. And e-cigarettes and products that are popular today, lower risk products, deliver nicotine in a way that matches with how cigarettes did it. And that's great. But there are regulatory hurdles that are not just regulatory, but are pushed by Big Pharma, which is funding a lot of the opposition because it's a threat, just like the cattlemen saw a threat. Big Pharma sees this as a threat to the gum in the patch, which by and large are highly ineffective delivery systems of nicotine. Nicotine, a product that the FDA approved in drug format. But now the pharmaceutical companies want to protect that space. Right. Even though that space has not been entirely productive.
So often there are interests that may use the precautionary principle or may argue that they're trying to prevent some danger to the public, pushing for regulation or banning or a tougher regulatory scheme on products simply because it horns in on profits that, you know, they may be, you know, getting with a relatively inferior product as from a consumer perspective.
And without any innovation, right?
Right.
When's the last
right.
time the patch got any better?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Well, let me ask, you know, this is, we've talked a lot about sort of the goal of what we'd like to see happen, and we'd like to live in a society that's innovation focused with a dash of regulation, as you said, to make sure that we keep things safe. What do we need to be doing as a society to encourage regulation? What do we need to be doing as a society, and what would you like the agencies to do, or what kind of mentality do you think you'd like them to bring to the table?
That is a key question. I think we can learn something from Impossible Burger's story. And hopefully once we get through this mass hysteria over e-cigarettes, I think we will start seeing data, especially out of the UK, where the government has been on the right side of that issue, limited regulation in this case. In fact, the government the UK has promoted e-cigarettes for smokers. I think when the data comes out, I hope and I encourage that we look at regulation not only as an opportunity to reduce or possibly try to limit risk, but actually to limit harm, to reduce harm, and to recognize that new innovative products, in fact, some we may not even have thought of yet to address current problems, or some that we may have given up on already. In fact, you know, people, one of the big problems I talked about smoking, obesity is a real public health problem. And some 25 years ago, Procter & Gamble started promoting a fat substitute called Olestra, or it was a type of fat that wasn't absorbed. And there were issues, and it became the butt of late night humor. But maybe they didn't get the science right, or they didn't deal with the controversy right. But that idea of having a good-tasting, enjoyable, science-based, science-driven, innovative product that can address obesity, so that we're not looking at this as a moral issue, you're enjoying food too much, or you're eating too much, or you're too lazy, right? Let's think about how science can contribute to reducing obesity. And if we can come up with, you know, Diet Coke, right? They're artificial sweeteners, and people don't like artificial things. And Diet Coke is not a health drink, but if you're going to want to enjoy a beverage, Diet Coke, with its artificial sweeteners, is a whole lot better from a health perspective than full sugar Coke if you're going to consume too much sugar. Here, it's a way of reducing risk. So I see diet soda as a harm reduction opportunity. But we haven't had much innovation in artificial sweeteners. We haven't had innovation in artificial fats or new types of fats like Olestra since Olestra, because innovators probably get scared off because of the regulatory hurdles. But if we stifle all of the research and the investment needed to support that research to come up with new products, we're not going to be addressing obesity, right? We can have sugar taxes, soda taxes, all the things that don't work. But we need to change our mindset, Will, to have an innovation-oriented mindset. And in order to do that, in order to foster it, we need to have an innovation-oriented regulatory system rather than an exclusively harm-oriented regulatory system. We have to weigh each new innovative thing and the frameworks for regulation have to take into account, just like we do supposedly in pharmaceuticals, yes, this drug may be harmful. There are risks associated with it, but what is it preventing, right? We need to think about chemical regulation, food regulation, all types of regulation in ways that we think more rationally, not only about the harm, but about the potential benefit of what may come about. That will, in effect, spur innovation. It will encourage new investment, that we could all lead better, healthier, and dare I say, more enjoyable lives and get along politically without trying to take away each other's choices. That, I think, is the goal that we need to have. You don't need to be a climate change activist. You don't need to be an anti-smoking activist. You just need to come together and say, hey, don't we all want to be healthier, have more freedom, be safer, and enjoy life? And I think that's the potential. If we change the perspective to allow for profit-driven, disruptive innovation.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for joining us today. I think these are great, important philosophical issues that we have to deal with collectively as we seek a maximally prosperous society. And these are some great examples of where there's been a tension between those efforts and how we might resolve those better in the future.
Thanks for having me on.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.